From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with Eric Castle, author of Animal Algorithms, Evolution, and the Mysterious Origin of Ingenious Instincts. Let's now join Hank and Eric Castle in their conversation.
Previously, people believed that, you know, animals were just all simple robots, particularly these less developed animals such as insects, and they had limited repertoire of behaviors, and they didn't think it was that complex. Well, turns out that's not the case. You find more and more as they study these behaviors, just how complex these behaviors are. And the aspect of this that I think really stands out to me is that, again, that the fact that a lot of these behaviors are occurring in animals with really tiny brains. And we think of humans, we think, okay, we've got these giant brains and we have all this neural capacity. We have, you know, tens of billions of neurons, and gives us a lot of flexibility in behaviors and be able to think. Well, that's one way of thinking about things. But when you look at these animals, they do not have these giant brains. They don't have the ability to really think in the sense that we are. And yet, somehow, these behaviors that are complex are programmed into these brains. And one of the aspects it demonstrates to me is how it requires such a high degree of design intelligence to even conceive and implement such a design in brains that are so tiny.
Design intelligence. I want to go back to the loggerhead sea turtles. Again, this is the image that you have on the cover of your book. And one of the points that ought to be elaborated on is the fact that the females, they don't become sexually mature until they're 20 to 30 years old. And then they're able to migrate back to the same beach where they were born, lay their eggs, and that somehow or other is imprinted as well in this brain. It's imprinted in their memory. So they can find something 20 or 30 years after they're actually born, go back to that same place and lay their eggs. I mean, that's astonishing in and of itself.
Right. Yeah, that's amazing. When they're born and they're hatched, as soon as they hatch, they immediately travel to the ocean and then swim out to sea. Well, somehow in this process, immediately after they're born, they have some kind of information that's imprinted based on their navigation sensors that tells them where that beach is located. And then, like you say,
this is like 30 years after they're born. I mean, it's just astounding.
Yeah, again, that's another element to this that we're really clueless as to how that even is possible.
One of the things that you bring up somewhat tangentially, and I don't know how much time you want to spend on this, but you mentioned global climate change. And it seems, at least by reading what you've written about this, that that is less of an existential threat than during the most recent ice age.
Yeah, that's an aspect that caught my curiosity as I was thinking about how these animals are, and particularly the long-distance migrating birds and the monarch butterfly. So in the case of the monarch butterfly, for example, it migrates back and forth. Like you say, it actually takes several generations, but the population moves from, well, there's several different populations, but in the one that most people are familiar with is the one that migrates from eastern Canada to a part of Mexico. But during the last ice age, obviously they were not residing in Canada because it was completely frozen and it was glacial. So I wondered about where were they migrating during the last ice age. I haven't come across any information about anybody that's done some research into this about where they may have resided during that period of time, but it gives you an indication that they actually did adapt. During the last ice age, they survived somehow. We don't know where, but they did survive, and then now we're past the last ice age, and then they migrate, you know, where they do between Canada and Mexico. But and there's a lot of other examples that are very similar to that, where animals obviously change their migration patterns, which brings up another question about all of this. And like we talked about earlier, many of these migration routes are actually in some way inherited. In other words, the offspring are born knowing where to migrate to. Well, if that's the case, how did they adapt over time with climate change? Because, again, the most recent significant example being the Ice Age, how are they able to change their migration patterns if it's actually somehow contained within their genome? We really don't know any of this about how that's even possible.
You have done engineering work for NASA and the FAA. You've been a consultant, and you point out in the book that if you compare the most impressive instances of animal navigation with the most advanced navigational systems of modern aircraft, you recognize a process that is top down. There are numerous reasons why this is top down and structured, and I think that's worth elaborating on as well.
Yes, exactly. And that's one of the reasons I became interested in the topic and thought it was instructive to address. And that is, from an engineering point of view, anybody who's worked as an engineer or even a computer programmer knows that in order to develop a system or a software program, it's a top-down process. You have to start with some higher-level goal, some purpose for the system, and then there's a number of steps that you go through to develop that system. And the same is true, well, again, my experience in particular with navigation systems, but other engineering systems that I've worked on as well, but it is a very structured, top-down process that you have to follow. And if you don't, you end up with mistakes. You end up with something that has design flaws in it. There's a recent example of this with the Boeing 737 MAX, where there were obviously some mistakes made during the development process of that system that ended up in two aircraft crashes. And so that's unfortunately a negative example, but it illustrates the point that when you have these complex systems, you have to go through a very rigorous, strict, top-down engineering process. A couple of aspects of why that's important. One is these are integrated systems. In other words, there's different elements to the systems that are involved. So in the case of navigation, you have sensors. You have a control system. In the case of aircraft, you have a flight control system. But in the case of animals, birds, they have their own flight control system. And then you have the actual algorithms themselves that are controlling the entire process. All of that has to be integrated. Otherwise, it's going to malfunction. And another word we use in engineering is coherent. They have to function coherently. In other words, work properly together. And again, the examples that keep showing up now in some of these animal systems indicate that these are highly engineered systems that actually rival the engineering that's involved in developing aircraft navigation systems. To me, that's one of the most amazing aspects of all of this.
So let's go back to the honeybee again. They have these specialized structures in the eyes and the brain to see polarized light. And thus, as you're explaining, they're able to navigate by that. And that brings up the issue of the coordinated development of the eyes and the brain and how evolution tries to account for that. So I oftentimes thought about the human eyes. Darwin called them organs of extreme perfection and complication. So I'm looking around as I'm speaking to you, and I'm sure you're looking around as well. And as we do, there's this vast number of impulses that are traveling from our eyes through millions of little nerve fibers, and they're transmitting information to this complex computing center in our brain called the visual cortex. And without the coordinated development of the eye and the brain in synergistic fashion, the isolated development of either is not only meaningless, but counterproductive.
Stay right there. We'll be back soon to rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Eric Castle. How do some birds, turtles, and insects process navigational abilities that rival the best man-made navigational technologies? Who or what taught the honeybee its dance? Or its hive mates how to read the complex message of the dance? How do blind mound-building termites master passive heating and cooling strategies that dazzle skilled human architects? In The Origin of Species, Charles Darwin conceded that such instincts are, quote, so wonderful that the mystery of their origin would strike many as a difficulty sufficient to overthrow my whole theory. In Animal Algorithms, Eric Castle surveys recent evidence and concludes that the difficulty remains, and indeed is a far more potent challenge to evolutionary theory than Darwin imagined. The best explanation is intelligent design. To receive your copy of Animal Algorithms, Evolution and the Mysterious Origin of Ingenious Instincts by Eric Castle, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. Anyone who's been paying attention knows there's a war going on, not just on traditional morality, civility, and decency, but even more fundamentally on historic notions of truth. And the enemy isn't just the onslaught of fake news facilitated by a post-truth culture and turbocharged by growing legions of ideological spin doctors. No, the real enemies of truth range from postmodernist convictions that there is no objective truth to militant scientism that claims that only science can determine truth, and religion is little more than primitive superstitions. But CRI support team members are not waving a white flag of surrender. They're holding the fort by undergirding every one of Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping and life-changing outreaches 24/7. To learn how you can make a difference and enjoy all the benefits of support team membership, simply visit equip.org. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. The Christian Research Journal's primary commitment is to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. In keeping with this commitment, the journal's mission is both evangelistic and pastoral, furthering the proclamation and defense of the historic gospel of Jesus Christ, and helping his followers distinguish between essential Christian doctrine and doctrine that is peripheral, aberrant, or heretical. In an age of subjectivism and moral relativism, may Christians ground their faith and values in the objective, reliable testimony of Holy Scripture. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org.
Truth Matters, Life Matters More by Hank Hanegraaff is essentially two books in one. Because Truth Matters, Part 1 equips Christians to defend the essential truths of the historic Christian faith. In Part 2, Hank explains why life matters more and how we can experience the height of human existence, union with God in Christ. Simply put, the map is not the territory, the menu is not the meal. We cheat ourselves of authentic union with Christ when we elevate the message above the Messiah. Truth Matters, Life Matters More is a modern classic and the magnum opus of one of the great theological minds of our time. To receive Truth Matters, Life Matters More, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift in support of the life-changing work of the Christian Research Institute. That's 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org.
Here again are Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, Eric Cassel, as they continue their conversation.
Without the coordinated development of the eye and the brain in synergistic fashion, the isolated development of either is not only meaningless, but counterproductive. And I think that's sort of what you're alluding to.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And in fact, it's interesting that Darwin actually addressed this issue in certain aspects. He discusses this issue of form and function. In order, for example, for a behavior to occur, you need two things at minimum. One is the form. You need the physical mechanisms to actually execute the behavior, like a bird flying, for example, or a fish swimming. But then functionally, you need some control mechanisms that actually perform the function or control the function. And Darwin wrestled with this, and he, in the end, he kind of dismissed this as not a significant issue. But as you alluded, it's not an insignificant issue because, particularly in the case of behaviors that we've been talking about, you have these different physical elements, and then you have what I'll call software elements, like things that are residing in an algorithm, for example. Well, it doesn't do much good to have one without the other. You could have a physical element capable of, like, for example, a bird having some navigation sensor, but if the bird does not have the algorithm to actually use that information to navigate, it's useless. And so how you can explain the origin of all of these different aspects developing through a random step-by-step Darwinian process in a holistic, integrated manner, to me, seems highly implausible.
You know, one of the geniuses of your particular book is that it's so interesting. I mean, you can get caught up in the technicalities of all of this, but you're constantly pointing to different animals like the ant or the beetle or bees or butterflies or the loggerhead turtle that we talked about. And then you're telling a story about each one of these, and you're opening our eyes to the complexities that are involved and just the majesty and mystery of these animal algorithms. I want to just emphasize that for a moment because I want people to get your book. And by the way, your book is available to anyone that wants a copy just by supporting the Ministry of the Christian Research Institute. So you can go to the web at equip.org and simply ask for your copy for your support of this ministry. But the genius of this book is the animals themselves. It's not complex. It's just intoxicatingly interesting. On the back of this book, it says, as a blurb from the Discovery Institute, how do some birds, turtles, and insects possess navigational abilities that rival the best man-made navigational technologies? Who or what taught the honeybee its dance or its hive mates how to read the complex message of that dance? How do the blind mound-building termites master passive heating and cooling strategies that dazzle skilled human architects? Well, in this book, you get a sense of how all of that takes place. And I think that's the intoxicating nature of the book and one of the reasons that people need to read this book. Because, again, when you read this book, the one thing that keeps going through your brain is, oh, my Lord, how majestic are your ways. You just revel in the majesty of God. Here's another example that you talk about in your book, the wasp. And the amazing ability that a wasp has to paralyze its captured prey. Doesn't kill it, but paralyzes it. And there's a reason for that. And how that sting accurately is made between two distinct plates on the underside of a bee's neck immobilizes that bee so it can be used as food later on.
Right. Yeah. I mean, again, it's one of those behaviors that is really difficult to explain, developing through some random mutation, trial and error kind of a process. Because in the process of the wasp executing this behavior, it's so exact that, okay, you could have a wasp try, 100 times to perform this maneuver. Well, chances are, okay, maybe it might get it right 1 out of 100. Well, how does such a behavior develop and evolve? That seems like such a highly improbable thing to occur through a random process. Yeah, it really is hard to explain.
Another thing you talk about in the book is complex program societies. And you've alluded to this, but if we consider the ant again, the species live in groups and they exhibit this complex behavior that's associated with social group lifestyles. So they're able to have this division of labor. They have castes. They have consensus building. They utilize symbolic language. So you have these complex social behaviors that appear to be programmed, and not programmed arbitrarily, but top-down programming for the very start.
Yeah, exactly. And again, these insects that reside in these, some people call them, in some cases, superorganisms, because you have a colony of ants that sometimes consists of millions, literally millions of ants that reside within the colony. But yet the colony as a whole exhibits behaviors such that the ants are able to carry out the proper behaviors at the proper time. So again, whether it's foraging food, finding another nest, tending to the queen, tending to the pupae, there's a number of different behaviors that the ants perform, but it somehow is all coordinated, but there is no master coordinator for the colony. In other words, there's not some top-down mechanism that's directing the ants to do the behaviors that they need to do. These are all basically independent animals. One way of thinking about it is now in the world of artificial intelligence, right, and people have actually developed these drones that perform different kinds of things, flying drones in some cases, and they're able to, in some ways, replicate what a large group of animals might perform, except that you're talking about an electromechanical drone programmed through artificial intelligence, but they're all independent actors. But in the case of these social colonies, there's a programmed control of the individuals, in this case ants, such that each ant is actually making its own decision about what behavior to perform at any particular time. But it's all coordinated such that, some group of ants will do behavior A, another group of ants will be behavior B, et cetera. And all of that is programmed into the brains of these ants somehow in this really complex algorithm and controlling the behavior of literally millions of animals within the colony. Again, it's just amazing.
And as you say, it would be the envy of a corporate manager. Even the altruism of termites is fascinating, and you write about that in the book as well. So this is particularly interesting and I think informative, instructive in that Richard Dawkins talk about the selfish gene, and yet you find altruism in termites where they will fight off army ants, and they'll give up their life for their fellow termites in the process.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, the animals aren't all selfish, as Dawkins, simplistically likes to view evolution, where animals are behaving in a purely selfish manner for their own existence or the existence of their offspring. And a lot of these social colonies, animals such as some of the ants, actually do exhibit altruistic behaviors where basically they're sacrificing themselves for the good of the colony. It's one of those aspects of this that's, again, a bit of a challenge for our Darwinian point of view.
Something else you write about that I found fascinating is insect architecture. So these structures built by animals that human architects are marveling at in the present.
Right, and I think you mentioned earlier the termites that build these amazing termite nests, which are really these giant mounds. And there's a lot of engineering that goes into the construction of these nests because they have a number of different elements to it. One of them is controlling the temperature. They're able to actually control the temperature within the nest, which is important because they can only exist within a certain temperature range. And then there's ventilation systems.
Well, we'll have to stop here for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Join us again next time when we'll continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Eric Castle. Our firm commitment here at the Christian Research Institute is to defend the faith once for all delivered to the saints and equip believers to become true disciples of Jesus Christ. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand CRI's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches, Hank would like to send you a copy of Animal Algorithms, Evolution and the Mysterious Origin of Ingenious Instincts by Eric Castle. Call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI. Once again, that's 888-7000-CRI. Or visit our website, equip.org. That's equip.org. Of course, you can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more. The number of wolves surrounding the Christian flock is growing, and they relish nothing more than docile sheep utterly incapable of defending themselves. From militant secularists at home to militant Islamists abroad, the assaults on biblical Christianity are growing dangerously. But Christian Research Institute support team members aren't in favor of feeding these wolves. Instead, each day they're making possible an array of outreaches that defang these wolf packs with solid arguments and evidence that have stood the test of time. What's more, support team members are equipping themselves with CRI's Equipping Essentials, a hand-picked collection of the best apologetics tools around. Your selection of resources, along with a complimentary subscription to the Christian Research Journal, are just our way of saying thanks. To learn more about the benefits of membership, simply visit equip.org. Once again, that's equip.org.